Well, to kind of dive into it before we you know jump into the movie, which I utterly loved. A little bit about your background. I didn't realize how much work you'd worked with Tony Scott and some of these big time directors that we get to see in the movie itself. How did you get started in sound design and Foley and all this work?
Yes, well, it was funny because the last thing I thought I would do coming out of film school was sound. I came out wanting to be an editor, and a picture editor, and for some reason in sound I didn't connect in the classes and stuff, and it seemed kind of technical, too technical, and I wasn't relating to story and character and all that with sound. So what happened was I had my thesis film left, all my classes were done, and my friend Dan Hageman, who had become a sound editor, called me up one day and said, Midge, none of the union guys will touch 16mm, and a big producer had brought a show in, 16, and he said, come in and I'll show you how to cut effects. And I took it because I needed the money to help finish my thesis film, and then you know, right away it was like, oh my gosh, I'm the one responsible for setting mood and tone and how do I use sound for character, and, you know, so I felt the pressure. And then I think because I had a musical background, like I always sang in chorus and choir, and I played the guitar, I think for some reason it just clicked in. And then I started to realize the importance of sound and how much we were, you know, adding to the picture, so to speak. And it was, and it became really exciting also because it was, you know, the 80s, the late 80s and the 90s and all those big shows and those big directors, you know, were working with surround sound and 5.1, and it was just kind of heady time for us sound people, I think, you know.
Was there a job that you got that you realized, okay, I think I can do this as a full career, or was that that first opportunity that
yes.
made you think that?
Well, you know, it was, okay, my first union job, so my big studio job was Days of Thunder, and I literally, my short documentary had come out, and it was, I got a really great review in the Hollywood Reporter, and I started to get calls from agents, and I literally was in my room at Paramount, and I was thinking, I really love this job. Like, what's the likelihood that I'm going to direct? And I really didn't respond very enthusiastically to the agents and stuff. I kind of let it go and thought, I'm loving doing sound. And on that show, I was assigned I always had, like, the bad guy's car. Whoever was racing against Tom Cruise, I had that car, the engine. And it was so fun, you know. And then we were thinking in terms of surround. And I also had all the kind of wide shots of all the NASCAR, the speedway kind of, you know, shots. And so they'd go by really fast, left to right and right to left. And it was... I mean, it was so exhilarating, you know. I mean, as a little kid, I remember my sister and I wanted to be race car drivers, so it kind of came back to me. I thought, oh, gosh, that was really fun.
So when did you decide to make this movie? When did you decide to kind of dive into the history of it all?
Well, honestly, I started researching and wanted to do it back in the early 2000s because I started to teach more. And I realized, oh, I'd love to get the word out because I was so passionate about sound. And even when I came to USC that cares about sound, they still had the description of classes were like visual storytelling. And I said, can we just put the word oral in there? And I was so excited to take the tools that I had now in these big kind of action-adventure movies and really apply them to the kind of smaller films, independent films, documentary films. And so I... 2002, and then I stopped because a friend of mine was making the one about editing, and Wendy Apple, it's called The Cutting Edge, and she said it took 2 years to get the rights to the clips, and I knew that was crucial, that you really need to play things to be able to understand what we're talking about in sound. So it wasn't until Bobette Buster, my producing partner, she was up at Pixar lecturing on story structure, and she met Gary Rydstrom, and she would give one of her lectures would be on sound, and she met Gary Rydstrom, and then she said, why hasn't there been this film? Would you be willing to do it? And he said, you should really talk to Mitch Foss and get her involved. So that's how we started, and then Karen Johnson was our, we Kate had her come on because she had done a clip show with Double Dare was a film she did about stunt women, which is really fun. And so she's been a huge help. And so we started in 2010, and then we brought the editor on, who was a student of mine at the time. Now, of course, practically has grandkids. It's been so long, but we're like, and then we started to just make movies out of other people's movies and just show them proof of concept, like this is what. But when you're in town, you're so used to people not like paying attention or having a really small budget or not getting enough time. And I mean, it took us a long time, and it was all privately funded. I mean, we didn't even get money from Dolby, to tell you the truth. So it's been a long ride, but totally worth it.
Wow, that's kind of crazy. I'm curious then, how long did it take to get all these interviews? What was the length of the shoots?
Yes, well, mostly we shot from 2013 to 2016, and really, we have 90 interviews, and the reason we do is there was hardly anything in that first generation. We had Murray Spivak from King Kong, but and luckily some like entertainment show did that one, but otherwise there was nobody else. And even to just find photos, still photos of anything to do with sound was really difficult. So I thought, we have to record this while we can. So we got all the great sound, most of them, and we were also thinking of doing international, but it's like, we just, because of budget and time constraints, it's like we ended up, it's mostly California, it's very California centric, but at least we really captured the people who are making, who are really doing sound these days. And so that was really important. Just, we have like 200 hours worth of material, and it's archived really well, where we broke everybody's interview down to subject matter and films they worked on and everything. So because it's just important to have it,
I'd love to know, when did you decide to make it in order, kind of the films? Was that something always thought of, or in the edit you guys figured it out that you want to start with, obviously the older stuff you kind of jump back into, but from like the 70s, 80s, yes, you hit that, yes, pinnacle first. I thought was really nice.
Yes. Well, we knew that was like, Bobette used to call it the quantum leap. And so we knew that there was this thing that happened, and it was really Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, Walter Murch getting out of Hollywood and wanting to do it more their own way, which was put more emphasis on sound, that, and other things that they did, not work on the studios, not do things differently, which is one of the reasons why we called it Making Waves. So that was really a key. We knew that that was a really important part, and we almost kind of started with that. And then we went back and got the history, and we had to know which films we were going to talk about, because that's part of fair use. The way that we could use clips without paying for them, which wouldn't be finished because we wouldn't have the money to pay for those clips. We had to know fair use. So our editor had to get to know anyone who was working on the film, and we had to ask the directors and the sound people about the specifics so that they could talk about that to be able to set it up. And legally we could use the clip. So we really did a lot of research. We look at all their body of work and then decide which kind of scenes we thought we might play. So that was really key. Yeah, a big part of the research.
When you guys switch to one of the elements I love and kind of the things I've loved in sound design is, you touch upon silence.
Yes.
And especially like the one that kind of popped into my mind was Sam Mendes on Road to Perdition, especially. Can you talk about the importance of silence in sound design, but also, the difference in taking sound out and putting sound in? I mean, I thought that was so fascinating.
Yes. We always say that that silence is sometimes the most important use of sound. And when you think of, music, it can't be completely loud and always, just like sound, it can't be bombastic all the time or really loud, because it loses its impact. So when you think about like Hitchcock, you know, it's in Orson Welles and a lot of people, it's really important to have quiet moments. And really the silence a lot of times is, it's not silent as we know when we're doing sound design. It's really that it's so quiet that you can hear like the single cricket or the creaking wood floor or somebody's breathing. And so that is so important. And you want people to lean in. I love those films. I worked on a lot of the big loud ones, and the other thing is we also get a bad reputation as sound people as if we want the film to be really loud, but that is a lot of times the directors or the producers at the mix are wanting it to be, you know, too loud, actually, to be honest. And then at the theater, they'll turn the whole sound down and you might miss the dialogue. And so for us, it's really important to get all of it. You always protect the dialogue because people will want to know what people said. Unless you're not supposed to hear them, but those are our concerns. So, but I think we get blamed sometimes for having too loud. But boy, I just love the quieter films. And you know, as I'm both an effects editor and a dialogue editor. And when you're cutting dialogue, sometimes the most important sound is how somebody breathes, because that tells you more than what somebody might say. You know, how do they feel? You can hear it in their body, like how somebody's breathing, like how what their emotions are. And actors know this because they study breath, you know.
You know, we talked a little bit about George and Francis and Walter Murch kind of starting the big movement and change. But one of the things I love that you guys touch upon is the importance of, I don't know if you guys necessarily like harbor on it, but I think you slightly showcase it. The importance of women in this sound design, editing. How important is it for you to showcase that there are equal number of amazing women in this industry on that side of it as well?
Well, that was really important to us. I mean, being three women that started the project. We also our director of photography is a woman. She shot my thesis film. We've been friends since. And then our composer, since film school, then our composer is a woman and all that. So it was really important to me because what happened in the early days is that women weren't cutting sound. In fact, Kay Rose was the first woman to win an Academy Award for sound, and she was cutting sound effects. But it turns out that they gave women dialogue editing to do, and dialogue editing is kind of, I mean, my friends who are women and dialogue editors would laugh about how it's like a sewing circle or something. You're stitching together little pieces of sound. So, you know, if somebody drops like an F on a word, you're going and finding it, putting it on, and, you know, you're setting up the tracks in a way that the mixer can mix them so that each take sounds similar to the other one, you know, because they all sound a little bit different. So, so dialogue editors would be women, and most people don't even know. I mean, some directors don't even understand what dialogue editing is all about. It's fixing the production. And and so the effects editors usually end up being supervising sound editors. That's why they ended up, you know, with the job. They're the ones who are kind of like, in history, that it might look like it's all men. So I made a big point of, you know, going to, you know, Kay Rose. Kay Rose, unfortunately, passed away, but her daughter, you know, is still alive. And she also was one of the earlier women working, you know, in sound, and Cece Hall. So what I did was make sure that women, when we went to do Verite and go to people working, I used a lot of women. If people don't pick it up, but if you look at who, like it's Anna Belmer who's mixing, and Eileen Lee is mixing and editing, and Terry Gwen Whittle is editing dialogue, and Teresa Acton, and so it's actually, when you see the people doing things, it ends up being women, like present day, and that's one of the ways I got a lot of women in there, and to me it was really important, and also to show diversity, you know, and show the different types of people who are, to say, you know, anyone can do this job, you just have to kind of love sound.
Well, thank you for doing that. It was insightful and eye-opening to so many levels, so thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you.
I'd love to know, you mentioned earlier you wanted to do this bigger and better and maybe even go international. But in some ways, you guys did get to go international. You guys got to go to Cannes.
Yes, that was fantastic. fantastic. And what was so great about that is that then a lot of film festivals around the world have picked it up. So I've been all over. I went after Cannes. I went to Munich and I went to New Zealand. And the film won an audience award in Bogota, Colombia. And I went to Korea, which was so great to see subtitles down the side of the picture. And even everywhere I've been, it's been so fun. People have been so passionate. They come up just loving the film and feeling really emotional about it. So that was so great that we got to go to Cannes. And all over. We've been so thrilled about that.
You know, I got to watch this on my iPad, so I feel really sad because I want to know the experience of what this must feel like in the theater, and I can't wait to eventually see it in the theater. Can you talk about that experience and what that was like, and showcasing it all around the world, but the theatrical experience of this movie must be incredible.
Yes, it's really great. Where are you?
Dallas.
Where are you located? You're in Dallas. Okay, hopefully it will come there. I know, just to, an aside, makingwavesmovie.com, you should look and see, I don't know if we're in Dallas yet, but where we went with I really wanted it to show in theaters, and one of the fun parts, which you'll see when you do see, I'm hoping you see it in the theater, when you see it in the theater, there's some fun things that happen with the speakers when we go to stereo, but then also during Walter Merchant, he says, we had never, and they're working on Apocalypse Now, it's like, we had never worked on a mono, a stereo film, let alone, you know, surround. And you actually hear his voice goes into all the different speakers, and it's really fun. People kind of laugh, or you hear people like, go, oh my God. So it's really fun to see it in the theater. So what we did is, I decided to go with, and my producing parties, we decided to go with a distribution company that would put it out into, like, art houses and get it into as many theaters, really work on getting it to as many theaters as possible. And I was in Boston visiting family, and I saw some documentaries that were in small theaters, and we called up the director of, like, Be Natural, which is a film that's been going around, and we asked, you know, who's distributing your film, because I like that it's in little theaters and all over. And so that was really an important part to us, because it will stream, but you know the people that you're going to be seeing it on a stereo. But you know, I have to say too that a lot of the, it's great to hear it in the theater, but you know, sound is as the pictures get smaller, the screen size gets smaller, sound is still so important, is going to make it even more important because it brings the emotion. So, and you know, and headphones are getting better, and there's like, because of VR, you know, they're doing 360 stuff. So, and people, I think, have better sound systems in their house and stuff. So it's still good on stereo, but it's really great to be in the theater. Yeah.
How exciting is it to see that sound is still important to new filmmakers? I love that you guys bring in Ryan Coogler, And you know, I mean, I look to movies like A Quiet Place that came out last year, and you know, it being such a, you know, sound is the most important thing. How crazy is it to look at that and realize that sound is still as important as it was to Walter in the 70s? It's special.
Well, you know, the reason why we even got Ryan Coogler is because he's probably the most sought after person to be interviewed to make movies or whatever, is that he was a student of mine, and he was at USC and he was directing, but he knew that he didn't know sound very well, and he took a whole semester where he, on an advanced, like, graduate project, he and his sound partner, Aaron Covington, and they ended up writing Creed together the semester that they did sound. But they did sound on a 12-minute movie where, and then the next semester he directed one of those. And so they recorded sound on the set, they did the sound design and editing, and they did all the mixing. And so he really cares about sound. So I love that. And his composer, he met at USC, who was at the Thornton School in a film composer's program, and that's where they met. Like, he used him, I think, his first semester as a student. So I just love that he cared enough about sound, and then he let us, you know, interview him a couple different times because he can see the importance of it. So that was really exciting. And then you were talking about A Quiet Place, and Eric Adol, who does Argo in our movie, he actually did sound on that with his sound. He owns a company, E Squared, with Ethan Vanderin. Ethan got cut out of the movie, unfortunately, but Eric is in there. And yeah, I mean, I think everybody comes now to school. It used to be that they didn't pay attention to sound at all. I can see the difference, and now I think they know it's the thing that they don't know. And what I hope comes across in the movie is, you know, all these big directors say sound is 50% of their movie. What we don't say is that, do you know how much the budget for post-production sound is? Usually 1% of a movie.
Wow.
When you figure visual, 1%, and yet they're saying it's 50% of their movie. So, and on the big shows that I did that were big action adventure movies, the budget might go up to like 3%. Whereas the visual effects is somewhere between 40 and 60% on those movies, you know? So it's so interesting. You get a really great bang for your buck for sound, I have to say.
And for my last question, Midge, I'm going to kind of switch it up. I love that you brought up that, you know, you got to teach, you know, Ryan and so many different people. You hear so many battles between people who just go out and make films or people who go to film school. As someone who's taught film school and the advantages of, you know, being at a USC or an NYU or even down here in Texas, UT Austin, how more helpful is it to have film schools? How does it make the filmmaker like a Ryan Coogler maybe even better than just, or do you not feel that way?
Well, you know, I'll be honest. The thing that kills me about when students go to film school sometimes is the debt that they come out with. That makes me always, you know, and when I'm on the admissions committee, and a lot of times I'll be trying to talk them into, can they get an internship or something? But here's the truth about it. When you go to film school, it's so much about it's networking, and you meet the people you're going to work with. Just like I was saying, Ryan has met a lot, like his editor edited a student film, composer worked on a student film. It's like you meet people, but you become good because you have to do everything. You become a good director, but as a sound person, you've also directed, done the lighting on a show, you've done everything, and you become almost, you can become a department head almost, because you understand the whole scope of making a film. And so when people come out of film school but then they're a production designer, it's like they get the big picture, and the same thing with sound. You get the big picture, so you understand you have to collaborate. It's not sound for sound's sake. You understand the process. You understand the editing process, what the editor's going through, and that's really, I think, the strength of going to film school. And also, you meet the people who you want to work with, because you're kind of in the trenches together, and you see who's working, you know, who's really focused and working hard, and where the talent is, and I think that's the big thing. Sometimes people forget that, you know, like I'll get interviewed and it's just the director does everything, and it's like, my God, I had such amazing collaborators, my two producing partners, Bob F. Buster and Karen Johnson, our editor was brilliant, David Turner, our supervising editor, you know, Tom Miller, and our DP, as I said, Sandra Chandler, our composer, Allison Newman. I mean, you know, these are all people actually who I know through USC too, and it's just that's like a really key thing. And I have never been to Austin, but UT Austin is fabulous, and I can't wait to make it to Austin. I know, like, that's a really important place for film and also music.
Well, Mitch, thank you so much. I don't want to keep you from BBC. I hope you knock it out of the park. And no, thank you for the time. Your movies is a real treasure, and I hope people get to see it.
Thank you, Gordon. That's really nice. Yeah, it was great talking with you, too.